The following podcast is brought to you by the Communication and Media Studies Department at Dominican University of California. Welcome to Vertical Journeys Podcast, where we'll dive into topics like my personal climbing journey, battling my fear of heights, the ethical responsibilities we as climbers bear, and climbing culture. Join us as we ascend into the fascinating world of climbing, one grip at a time. Welcome to another episode of Vertical Journeys Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest joining us. Dirk is a climber who has witnessed the changes that have swept through the climbing world over the decades. His climbing journey spans generations, and he has seen the culture, equipment, and values of the sport change throughout the years. From the pioneering days of traditional climbing to the modern era of cutting-edge technology, he has experienced it all. Today, we have the privilege of diving deep into Dirk's experiences, hearing the tales of his ascents, and witnessing the birth of new climbing ethics. Hi, Dirk. It's a pleasure having you join us today. Can you tell us about your very first climbing experience and what drew you to the sport in the first place?
Hi. Thanks for that question. I guess probably like most kids, my first climbing experience was trees. I used to climb trees all the time. But if you mean my first more traditional climbing, that would be in my freshman year of college, where we were pretty advanced in that we had an elective that was just a half a credit. That let you take a climbing class. And the instructor was this climber who wanted to make some money in the, trying to do what he loved. So he was very chill. And we would go to local crags. An old quarry was a popular spot. And we learned to top rope.
It's incredible that they offered an elective with so much perceived danger involved. It's hard to imagine that would be available as a class today. What were the most notable differences in climbing equipment when you began climbing? And how have those changes impacted the sport?
So I started climbing in the late 70s. By that point, a lot of the same kinds of equipment were being used in mainly we're talking about free climbing. I guess the biggest difference is that the equipment nowadays weighs so much less with the same or better safety profile. So we were lugging up very heavy amounts of equipment. In particular, what makes climbing so much easier these days are the introduction of cams. And by the time I stopped climbing in maybe the late 80s, cams were just being introduced. They make placing protection much easier because each cam can fit a variety of crack sizes and even outwardly flared cracks sometimes. So placing nuts and other small gear like that requires a bit more skill and the also more time to find the right size. So you're holding on to the rock quite a bit trying to find the right placement, and it maybe required a little bit more skill.
It's amazing to think about just how far the gear has come. As a newer climber, it's hard to imagine primarily working with nuts as protection. Can you share some stories about your early experiences, including any notable stories and any change in the ethics that you've noticed over the years?
I started, again, climbing in the 70s, and that was a period when climbing was transitioning and becoming, I guess, maybe one of the first surges in the climbing's popularity. So that was a period when what was called clean climbing became a very big part of the ethics, and that persists till today. What clean climbing means is no more use of pitons, which clearly mar and scar the rock permanently. And then there was also a lot of climbs were being aided, and that means you're using some sort of way other than just the rock to advance yourself up the rock face. So these climbs were being what's called freed. So people were no longer aid climbing and trying to climb those same climbs with just using the rock. One of the my most adventurous climbs, which was probably pretty stupid of me to actually try, was an attempt up the Long's Peak Diamond, which was a, I don't know, at least 1,000, probably 1,500 foot cliff face at alpine elevations. So it topped out close to the top of Long's Peak, which is over 14,000. And we started climbing. I didn't do any of the leading, and we got going, and I started getting headaches and altitude sickness. It started snowing on us. Again, you know, alpine conditions, although midsummer, there was thunder clouds up ahead and lightning. In the end, we had to retreat doing 10, 15, in that order, rappels. And rappelling is one of the more dangerous aspects of climbing, and we had we didn't make it out until much later, well after dark. It was quite an adventure. Maybe not the wisest thing, but it makes a great story. Another story that comes to mind is when I was climbing in the Gunks. This is the Shuang Gunks, which is a place where a lot of early hard climbs were established. This is in the East Coast, not too far outside of New York City, and it's a beautiful, really long rock face. Well, I was leading a climb up there, and I grabbed a rock, which as a handhold, but it turns out it was just a free rock that was maybe a good foot long, and it slipped out of my hand, and it fell. Of course, I shouted, "Rock, rock, rock," so that everybody can cover their heads and be aware. It ended up landing right next to one of the big names in the Gunks climbing scene, which is John Stannard, almost hitting him. And I guess I would have been kind of infamous if I'd hurt him or you know, God forbid, killed him.
Your stories underpin exactly why many of us get into climbing in the first place. And that's for the adventure and the memories that will stick with us for the rest of our lives. So, how has climbing culture changed over the years? What's a notable difference you see in your generation versus the current one?
When I started climbing, climbing meant outdoor climbing. That's all there was. So there weren't any gyms, and which is all that some people know of as climbing. So most people now start in a gym, and some of them decide that they want to take that and go outdoors with it. Part of the ramifications of climbing only outdoors, especially where I did it in the Northeast United States, was that pretty much 4 to 5 months of the year, things were snow covered, and you basically couldn't climb. So that meant that you had to get your fitness level back and get your mental state back into climbing It's much easier now that you have gyms to practice at. The other thing was that climbing for us was very much of a personal experience that you shared with one or two really good friends that you'd learned to trust your life to. And the idea of competing and racing up a mountain was kind of anathema to what we thought of as our climbing, ethics, I guess. And now I very much enjoy watching climbing competitions. It's not a bad thing. It's just a different thing.
It's true. Gyms have created a level of access to climbing that just didn't exist before. I have a climbing mentor who I owe my current climbing ability to. Do you have anyone that you attribute as your climbing mentor? Who are they and what have they accomplished?
Well, I always looked up to my good buddy, Rob Kahan, who I went to college with. We climbed together a little bit in college, but mostly it was with another friend, and we would go, the three of us, on climbing trips. I'd climb with my other friend, John, but Rob Kahan was practicing and honing his rope soloing technique. This is a technique where you first climb a pitch of rock, and then but with protection, then you rappel down and you remove all your protection, then you climb back up using your previous rope that you had left anchored atop. If you're doing that on a big wall, you then have to also haul all of your gear up, so it's a lot of work. Anyway, he was practicing this technique and eventually took it to El Capitan, which most people know is a beautiful 3,000-foot rock face in Yosemite Valley. There he did a first ascent of one of the major routes, the West Buttress Route up El Capitan. It took him 11 days, and it was quite a harrowing experience.
Wow. I can't imagine just how much stamina and mental fortitude is required to complete such a feat. Are there any specific climbing destinations that hold a special place in your heart? And can you describe what makes them unique?
I mentioned before that I'd done some climbing at the Shuanggungs and that I'm in primarily East Coast climber. So, yeah, I'd have to say the Gunks, which people, they affectionately call it the Gunks because Shuanggungs is a mouthful, is just a beautiful destination for climbing. It's about maybe 100 to 300 feet high and it's miles long. So climbers get really spread out and you're not right on top of each other. The other great thing about it is it's sedimentary rock that has been shifted up. So and as different layers of the sedimentary rock erode, it makes for amazing ledges that you can have, a great rest on and sit and see the beautiful views. At the same time, there are wonderful overhanging sections and even such that there are easy climbs that are overhangs because of the way the rock has eroded. So that's kind of unheard of. Usually once you get to overhanging climbing, it's quite difficult. So that was just lots of fun. And I guess it also has a special place in my heart because it's where I did a lot of my climbing at a particularly influential part of my climbing career.
It was a pleasure getting to hear about your stories and perspectives, Dirk. Thank you for joining us.